Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. This week, the CEO of General Motors resigns after a quarter in which the company announced something quite unusual, a profit of $1.3 billion. Did he do something wrong? Also, the company is anticipating an IPO. That's right, an IPO, initial public offering for one of America's oldest companies. In 2009, lenders wrote off as uncollectible. By the way, that's a company that got a bailout. In 2009, lenders wrote off as uncollectible $11.1 billion in home equity loans and $19.9 billion in lines of credit. Now, small businesses are having trouble getting credit from the banks. And Republicans prevented a vote on a bill to put money into banks' hands to lend money to small businesses. What a great idea. It was announced yesterday that the American trade deficit had grown larger, and all the news media, including the so-called liberal media, were reporting that as a sign of a bad economy. Am I missing the point here? We'll explain. In other economic news, the Japanese yen hit a new high against the dollar. Great news, Japanese. But Japanese economists and others there are quite upset, and with good reason. Anyone in class know why? We'll come back to you in a few moments. Former Senator Ted Stevens dies in a plane crash, and news reports talk about him being cleared of the charges that drove him from the U.S. Senate. That is simply not true. And after months of hovering near 50-year lows, mortgage rates have fallen even further to such a level that lenders say more homeowner refinancing is finally starting. The federal judge who ruled that the ban on gay marriage violated the Constitution said that the unconstitutional violation can go on for another week. We'll tell you why we think that the pro-Proposition 8 advocates are going to have a really hard time getting the Court of Appeals to stop the parade of newlyweds. At least one prominent GOPer has come out against changing the 14th Amendment to prohibit citizenship for native-born Americans who are born to illegal aliens. Mike Huckabee apparently has decided not to run for president in 2012. And in Illinois, former Governor Rod Blagojevich, who won't clear my spell check, is awaiting a jury verdict in his trial on a series of criminal charges. The judge has ordered the jury to continue deliberating. They've agreed unanimously on two counts, but can't reach consensus on the remaining charges. Apparently, they can't come to an accord on just how much of a slimeball he really was when he apparently tried to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat. And to show that all politicians haven't lost their senses of humor, Ben Quayle, name sound familiar, who's running for Congress, where else, in Arizona, has called Barack Obama the worst president in United States history. His dad, as you'll likely remember, was vice president and did such a fine job and was such an intellectual giant that Ben's in a great position to judge. Also, he seems like a great candidate. He recently acknowledged using a pseudonym to contribute sex-themed comments to the online site DirtyScottsdale.com, and after allowing a campaign brochure to imply that he and his wife had two daughters, acknowledged that he has no children and the girls were his nieces. Yeah, he's going to be a great Republican candidate for Democrats. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That, of course, would be me. All that, news of the weird, our guest, Rich Ocheck, to talk about his books, Organic Gardening and Herbalism and Health. Also, if there's time, This Day in History and our Endpoint essay. So we have a jam-packed show for you this evening, and if you'd like to join us with your phone calls, it's 347-994-3796. pardon me. We have an announcement first, of course, and that is that our book, The Mobile Millionaire, A Guide for Small Investors with Regard to Investing in Mobile Homes, is available now on Amazon.com. And you can go to Amazon.com, and in the search box, you can either put Jeff Bushman or you can put Mobile Millionaire. By the way, if you just put Bushman, you'll find a number of books on Aborigines, which are almost all fascinating, but may not be exactly what you had in mind. So you may want to put Jeff Bushman and or Mobile Millionaire. Should you desire to read an excerpt, take a look at our lovely book cover, and if you're interested, buy the book. Let's talk about some of the news we highlighted a few minutes ago. pardon me. The trade deficit. Okay, it's time for Esoteric Economics 101. Okay, and there's going to be another part of this class as well in a moment. The trade deficit grew larger. For those of you who don't know, or those of you who need a reminder from the actual Econ 101, the trade deficit, or in the rare case, in a very rare situation, if it were the United States in modern times, trade surplus, reflects how much we buy from other countries and how much we sell to other countries. If we buy more than we sell in dollar terms, as opposed to number of products, then we have a trade deficit. If we sell more than we buy, okay, we have a trade surplus. It used to be the United States always ran surpluses, but that's decades ago. We have for a very, very long time run trade deficits, and the trade deficit goes up and it goes down, and some economists get into a panic when the trade deficit is higher or if it's high for a sustained period, because they have been saying for probably 30 years that we cannot sustain that kind of situation. But we have, and I expect we will, so long as the Chinese continue to finance our budget deficits. But in terms of the trade deficit, everybody was talking about the growth of the trade deficit being a bad sign. But it really isn't. It's actually quite a good sign if you think about it. At least that's one way of looking at it. It means that we are buying more than we've bought recently. If we're buying more, that means, first off, that people feel more confident in terms of the economy. People don't buy when they're scared. And additionally, it also means that there's more money flowing into the economy from consumers, which is the most rapid way to do that. And therefore, this is not only a good reflection on the economy, but it's also a good indicator of what may happen in future months and years. So an increase in the trade deficit is not universally bad. Also, the Japanese are not excited about the fact that the yen hit a new high against the dollar. And what this basically means is that the Japanese yen is worth more than it was before, and the dollar is, relative to the yen, worth less. Some would argue that the dollar is worthless anyway, but in terms of currencies, the only way you measure currencies anymore, since we went off the gold standard in the 1970s under Richard Nixon, or I should say the fixed price of gold, not the gold standard, but in any event, the way you measure the value of currencies is as against one another. So the dollar is up or down against the euro, it's up or down against the yen, and what a currency is doing as against a number of other currencies will give a reflection of how much confidence the world or world finance people have in that country's currency. Okay, that Japan's yen hit a new high against the dollar is a reflection of either or both factors, that people have great confidence in Japan's economy, its strength, or very low confidence in the United States' economy, or at the very least, greater confidence in the Japanese yen as against the dollar than they had before. Why is Japan not happy about that? The answer is simple. In order for Japan, which is also experiencing a recession, in order for Japan to recover, it has to sell products outside Japan. Its biggest single market is, of course, the United States, even though we are buying, as one of my friends says, more plastic crap from China than we used to. We're still buying a lot of things from Japan, and the less we buy, the less able Japan will be to get out of their economic doldrums. So when their yen hits a high against our dollar, that means that Japanese goods are relatively more expensive since they're denominated in yen. And just to give an example of that in case it's not clear, if something costs a yen in Japan, that doesn't really change under normal circumstances. But if the yen is worth $2, and so therefore it takes $2 to buy that product, If the Japanese yen's value goes up to $4, these are all artificial numbers, by the way. The yen is worth far less than a dollar. But if the Japanese yen goes up to $4 when it was previously $2, now that same yen product obviously takes $4 and is more expensive, even though in Japan it doesn't cost more. Likewise, if the Japanese yen was only worth 50 cents, now that same dollar will buy two of that product as opposed to one when the yen was worth a dollar. I hope that's reasonably clear. But the bottom line on it is that having a high value currency against other currencies is not a good thing when you're trying to increase your exports, and that's what Japan wants to do in order to relieve their recession. Japan typically runs a trade surplus with the United States, as do many other countries. Ted Stevens died in a plane crash. He had been a senator from Alaska and an early supporter of Sarah What's-Her-Name. And the only reason that has any importance at all is because, I mean, his death, of course, is very important to his family and perhaps a number of Alaskans. But the reason it's worth reporting on is because the news media all reported that he had been exonerated of the charges that of the crimes he had been charged with, and he had resigned from the Senate to fight those charges, and he was essentially declared not guilty. Not true. What happened was is the prosecutors misbehaved. They shouldn't have done that. It was unfair to him. But they misbehaved in not providing what is called exculpatory evidence, that is, evidence that would tend to be in his favor. They didn't present that to his attorneys, which they are under the law required to do. When the judge found that out, he punished the prosecutors by eliminating, I'm not sure whether the judge actually eliminated the ability to put evidence into the court case, or simply dismissed the charges against Stevens. But he was never determined to be not guilty. He was not exonerated. He was not absolved. He just wasn't convicted. There is a difference. I'm not suggesting that I know he was guilty. I am saying that that's not the same thing. The same thing is true, by the way, if you have a situation where someone is pardoned. The former governor of Arizona, Fife Symington, was pardoned by Bill Clinton when Bill Clinton was leaving office. That didn't mean he wasn't guilty. He had been convicted, and he wasn't exonerated. Bottom line is he was forgiven. That's what a pardon is. Now we're talking about mortgage rates having fallen in the economy. This is because relatively few people have been able to borrow money, either because they were uninterested or lately because there wasn't a lot of money available. Well, presumably from the reports, mortgage money is available for refinancing or for really cheap home purchases relative to prior market conditions. And now the rates have fallen low enough that more people are coming into the market to refinance their mortgages, to borrow money against their property. Unfortunately, of course, houses are not worth as much as the existing mortgages were in many cases, so there are only a limited number of people who would qualify, or a relatively small number of houses that would qualify, for such refinancing. But at least there are more people coming into this market than have been there before. That's generally considered a good thing. We mentioned this day in history. We'll come back to the news in just a minute, and we also have news of the weird. Let me give out the number again if you're interested in joining us. It's 347-994-3796, and in about, 15 minutes? Yeah, 14 minutes. In about 14 minutes, we'll be joined by Rich Ocheck, who is going to be a very interesting guest for you to hear. I suggest you stay tuned, because it's going to be far more interesting than listening to me. This day in history. On this day in history, the Spanish-American War was ended with the signing of a peace protocol. A few months ago, the war on Hispanic heritage was expanded in Arizona. As Mr. Smirnoff used to say, what a country. It's worth noting that in Florida, one of the Tea Party wingnuts is suggesting that a bill should be passed in that state requiring all legal immigrants to carry an ID card so identify them. And if they didn't have the card under that bill, they could be arrested. What's interesting about this is even the rather far-right-wing Republican senatorial candidate, now I can't remember his name, I can't remember his name at the moment, but he came out against it. saying, in effect, that he thought that might lead to racial profiling. Now, if he's saying that, imagine how horrible this bill must be. News of the weird. We'll skip around a little bit here. Colorado gubernatorial candidate Dan Mays, we're in politics again, but this is news of the weird. He said he used to support establishing bike lanes for his outdoor-loving state, the state of Colorado, but now he can no longer support such activity on the part of the state government because he studied up on the activist International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, which is an organization that supports bike lanes in cities. He learned that that organization is part of a UN cabal. He said, quote, if you do your homework and research, you realize that ICLEI is part of a greater strategy to rein in American cities under a United Nations treaty. Yeah, that's going to be a problem. So apparently the only solution is to run down people in bike lanes or something. I mentioned early on that Mike Huckabee is against changing the 14th Amendment. As many of you know, the 14th Amendment says, among other things, that someone born in this country is a citizen of the United States and of the state in which she or he is born. A number of conservative Republicans and crazy people have said that they want to change the 14th Amendment to create a situation that if an illegal alien mother has a child in this country, it should not be a citizen. There are even some of these Looney Tunes who suggest that you don't need to amend the Constitution. You could just do this by a law, a federal law. Well, first off, no such federal law will pass in the foreseeable future. And as far as a constitutional amendment is concerned, and for those of you who don't remember, but you're certainly invited to look at the Constitution, in order to amend the Constitution, the reason we don't have very many constitutional amendments is because it's really, really hard to amend the Constitution. First, it has to get a two-thirds majority of both houses of Congress to send an amendment out to the states. Then three-quarters of the states, through their legislatures typically, although it could be by an initiative or referendum, but three-quarters of the states have to approve, pardon me, the constitutional amendment. The likelihood of getting three-quarters of the state's legislatures to approve such an amendment to change the way citizenship is conferred upon someone who was born here seems not terribly likely, fortunately. On the other hand, if the Republicans want to run on that in this election year or 2012, I say more power to them. Go for it, guys. Please do this. Please. Mike Huckabee has come out against it. I mentioned apparently he's decided not to run for president. There are enough people in the Republican Party who really think this is a good idea, and since it is the more extreme folks in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party on the other side who vote in primary elections, it's hard to believe he would come out against anything that is extreme if he were really planning on running. So I am suggesting and predicting Mike Huckabee is out of the 2012 race by his own decision. Not his own decision on this controversy, but he came out about this controversy because he's decided not to run. Otherwise, he wouldn't have done this unless he were for the changing of the amendment. In California, the United States District Court judge who ruled that the ban on gay and lesbian marriage violated the U.S. Constitution had ruled today that in a week, or perhaps it was yesterday, in any event, on August 18th, I believe it is, the ban on gay marriage will be off in California. The reason he did this was essentially at the request of those who are against gays and lesbians getting married to one another. I don't mean lesbians will get married. Well, never mind. You know what I mean. In any event, the reason for the delay in the effect on his ruling was to allow those who are opposed to homosexual marriage to file an appeal and to seek from the Court of Appeals, which is the appellate court to which these cases go from the district court, to issue a stay pending the hearing on the appeal. There's a little problem with that, however. It is not at all clear. There's a problem for the people who are against gay and lesbian marriage. It's not at all clear that the Court of Appeals will, in fact, halt the effect of the ruling that was issued last week. And let's just talk for a second as to why that is. Usually, the only way you can get any court to issue that kind of order is if you are alleging that irreparable harm will come to you if the ruling is allowed to proceed, and if you have at least an arguable position that it will cause you that harm, irreparable and immediate harm. The problem is the state of California, through the governor and the attorney general, have essentially laid down in terms of the challenge to Proposition 8. That was the ballot initiative, the ballot initiative that passed a constitutional amendment to ban gay and lesbian marriage. The state normally would defend that, and they did not. The governor, Schwarzenegger, and the attorney general, Jerry Brown, both essentially agreed with the folks who brought the lawsuit to stop the implementation of Proposition 8, that Proposition 8 was contrary to the United States Constitution, so they didn't fight it. They might be able to make an argument that allowing the ruling to go through would cause irreparable harm to the state because of having to go through the administrative process of allowing those marriages or the state cities or something. But the folks who sponsor Proposition 8 are going to have a very hard time demonstrating an immediate and irreparable harm to them. Just saying that I don't like this rule or it's going to ruin marriage or any of that sort of thing is very unlikely to result in a stay of the district court's order. So the only thing you can say about what happens in court next, I guess, is the old radio expression, please stay tuned. Speaking of which, I hope you will stay tuned. Because our guest is going to be joining us, that's Rich Ocheck, in about 5 minutes. So he'll be joining us, and you can join me now or us after he does at 347-994-3796. And the other bit of news of the weird we have for you tonight, there wasn't a lot of this today, if you eliminate the Ben Quayle story, that is. There was a man named Gerald Maxwell who was caught breaking into and entering the same house he had committed the same crime at 2 years prior. He showed off his quick mind when the police caught him. He said, "I was going back in there to leave a thank you note." He was summarily arrested, as you might guess. Also on this day in history, a couple of other items. In 1851, the Singer sewing machine, or Mr. Singer, it was Isaac Singer, who invented the sewing machine, gained a patent on it. That was on August 12, 1851. And on August 12, 1898, Hawaii was annexed to the United States. Basically, it became part of our territory without becoming a state. It was a territory and remained so until, I am pretty sure it was 1959, but I may be corrected on that. It may be 1960. As a matter of fact, I think it was 1960 that Hawaii became a state. But we're not sure. I just consulted with my in-house expert, and she wasn't sure either. In 1944 on this date, August 12th, Joseph P. Kennedy Jr. was killed in a plane crash over England as a result of the war, and he was apparently the victim of those wonderful folks who brought you the Volkswagen and Auschwitz. Also in history, yesterday's date, which we will talk about in our endpoint essay, was the 45th anniversary of what became known as the Watts Riots. While we're waiting for Richo, we will take a quick look here at some other items in the news. I think we've covered most of the items in the news, actually. We planned that generally fairly well. If you are running a business and have a website and are not blogging, let me refer you, if I may, to jeffonblogging.blogspot.com, and you'll learn how to do a blog yourself if you wish to, or have it done by a professional writer. While we're waiting for Richo, let me tell you a couple of things about him. He has been described as the plant whisperer, and he is an author of a number of books, and he is the owner of Mountain Rose Herbs, and I think we'll let him tell us more about himself if I can bring it up. Are you there, Richo?
I just logged on.
Okay, and here you are. How are you, sir?
I'm just fine. How are you?
I'm terrific. I was just beginning to tell people about how wonderful you are when you joined us. You interrupted.
I noticed you said something about owning Mountain Rose Herbs. Those are some friends of mine. Actually,
beg your pardon.
I'm the principal for Horizon Herbs.
I apologize. Actually, I did know that. It is my mistake. I was reading the wrong line in my own notes. I apologize.
No problem.
Okay. Well, first off, in addition to being an author and an expert on herbs and healing herbs, you are, as I understand it, an ethnobotanist.
Well, yes, I like to travel around the world and look at plants, botanize, as it were, and make collections of different kinds of seeds and bring them back to the United States and grow them out and see how they adapt to organic gardening in the U.S.
And that's a lot of what you do as well, correct, is organic gardening?
Right. Well, we have a 5-acre certified organic seed farm and then a state certified nursery where we grow the plants, medicinal herb plants, and sell them to people in the U.S.
That's great. Now, I know you're in Oregon. What town are you in Oregon?
We're in southern Oregon. We're in the little town, cul-de-sac, in the Siskiyou Mountains, known as Williams, Oregon. It's not far from Ashland. A lot of people know about Ashland because
sure.
of the Shakespeare Festival.
Right. And before we go any further, just so that people know and can learn more about you, if someone is interested in going to the website, it's horizonherbs.com.
Horizonherbs.com. It's easy to find. We use the search term medicinal herb seeds on Google,
sure.
and then you get we're top placement there.
Terrific. Okay.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a stupid sounding question. How did you first get into medicinal herbs and herbalism?
Well, you know, I've been interested in plants ever since I was very, very young. My brother was a rock hound, and our family vacations were designed around his interest in searching for rocks, but he would come back to the family car, and this was the early 60s, mind you, with the sacks of different kinds of rocks, and I would come with my pockets filled with seeds. And so I was always looking at the growing green world, and eventually I ended up doing some archaeology. That was what my professional training was in.
Yeah.
Spent 3 years in East Africa, and when I was there, I became less and less interested in looking at stones and old bones and more interested in how the local folks utilize local plants in health care. And
mm-hmm.
so this was an interest which then grew through the I came back to the States in 75, and we started diverse gardens and then specialized in medicinal herb growing, and now we have about 1,000 species on the farm here.
That's amazing. And these are herbs that you sell, of course, around the world through the website.
Well, they're medicinal herb seeds that we grow, and we have a sort of a living collection here, and then, yes, we package them up. We've got a small, community and family business around growing different herb seeds and selling them through the website.
That's great. And you've also written a book on the subject, Medicinal Herb Grower, right?
The Medicinal Herb Grower is our most recent publication, and that covers the theory and practice of what we call natural gardening techniques, and then also talks about creating plant habitat on the land and finding the exact conditions where wild plants can be domesticated. That's often what's needed with medicinal herb growing is domesticating a wild plant so that we can have it nearby to us and so that we can conserve it, because a lot of them are disappearing in the wild.
Sure. Isn't echinacea an endangered species?
Well, there are nine different species of wild echinacea in North America, and among those nine species, one of them is a federally listed endangered plant. That is Echinacea levigata, which is native to the southeast. And then there's another one that is endemic, that is that it grows only in a small localized area, and that's
right.
Echinacea paradoxa, which the paradox is that it's a yellow-flowered purple cone flower. And so, yeah, there are native populations of the different Echinacea species still intact in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and they are not all endangered, but
okay.
they're often grown by gardeners and very successfully, I would say. Very beautiful plant.
Yeah. I apologize, by the way. I shouldn't have used the word species in that context, but an endangered plant, I guess. You were going to say?
Well, yeah, and there are such things as native land races. Those are the species type of the plant, and they will demonstrate some variability. And then there are also selections which are done by scientists, gardeners, hobbyists, which will exhibit other characteristics that are not found in the native land races. And at Horizon Herbs, what we're interested in are not the fancy hybrids, but instead the standard types that one would find in the wild.
Okay, good. You're speaking more of the plants that have not been hybridized.
Correct. Right, because once we start to hybridize and change them, then the original type can be lost, and somebody
right.
needs to conserve the original, more like heirloom varieties, and so that's what we're interested in here.
Sure. Talk a little bit, if you will, about the value of herbal medicine to a population or to an individual, as contrasted with drugs, if you will.
Well, drugs are complicated, and they are administered by health professionals because they have very specific actions and can be misused very readily and have to be used with a great deal of training and conscientious care, because they can
right.
be overdosed and what have you. Whereas medicinal herbs are closer to a food, a type of food,
mm-hmm.
which the body may or may not be able to utilize for ameliorating a certain symptom or disease issue. And they're usually gentler, although there can be toxic ones as well, of course.
Right.
And some of them can be quite safe and can be utilized by people who have relatively little training but can be quite effective. So
right.
what we encourage people to do is grow a few common medicinal herb varieties in the garden and kind of get used to the lifestyle, where one grows a certain amount of one's food and perhaps some tea items and perhaps a few simple herbs, and utilizes them in home health care. And when you kind of get over the hump and you start to be able to work with, you know, common ailments, things like colds and fevers, you know, non-life-threatening ailments,
right.
with vegetables, herbs, and culinary herbs and medicinal herbs right out of the garden, then it's empowering. You
right.
you can be responsible for your own health care. it's inexpensive. It doesn't really cost you anything. And then
Are very few side effects.
There can be side effects, but normally there are very few side effects. And there are many side benefits, like, for instance, fresh air, exercise, positive thinking, being able to share these things with other people in the environment, in the immediate area. So, on one hand, you don't want people to overstep themselves and self-medicate when they really need medical assistance. But on the other hand, there are a great many preventive foods or medicines which prevent different kinds of ailments or just improve the overall life force so that actually you don't have to go to the doctor or you don't have to take pharmaceuticals. So that would be the comparing and contrasting. I think if you let your health go too far, then you end up being in crisis, and sure, you may need help in the hospital. If you instead are looking after yourself and really taking care of your the foundations of health, like eating a lot of vegetables, eating broccoli, which dissolves the beginning breast cancer, eating cabbage, which is extremely helpful for the gut, and if you improve your digestion, then you improve really all things about your health. Eating greens out of the garden. This is a lot of people are surprised to know that in a cup of standard greens, like collard greens, there's more vitamin C than there is in an orange, which is sent from far away. So you're reducing your food miles and increasing the vitamins and the assimilability of your food into your own body and working it up into a kind of a lifestyle which is positive and inexpensive and empowering
and extremely healthy.
And it can be quite healthy. And what happens is a lot of times you go from eating very complex foods like fried foods and chips and this sort of thing and beginning to eat much gentler foods that are gentler on your digestion. And after a while, if you eat these simple foods, you gain a taste for them and you begin to become conscious of the excellent tastes and the incredible textures of simple things like a new potato boiled and mixed with a little parsley butter. You know, something of this nature is much better for you and much simpler for your body to make into energy than something which has many, you know, food ingredients like that you would get in a fast food, for instance.
And if you allow yourself to get used to that kind of eating, it tastes very good, and you're not missing anything. You're gaining things.
You are making for yourself in the morning a bowl of oatmeal that has absolutely no embellishment, just oatmeal, and take a spoon of that and put it in your mouth and really taste what it is that is oats, which is one of the Neolithic founder crops. I mean, it goes back to basically the very beginnings of our Neolithic farming traditions all the way up through today. And there are good reasons why ancient civilizations chose these simple grains as the staff of life. And now in our complex world, we find that these simple things are actually the cure for much of what ails us in our society.
Yeah, I have to share with you that I was agreeing with you on everything until you said eat oatmeal unembellished. I need bananas in my oatmeal. But other than that, I agree.
Okay, very good.
Let me ask
Well, all of us have a little monkey in our ancestry.
my last name is Bushman for a reason. But let me ask you, if you would, you mentioned these things these substances that help people who have a slight cold or a little bit of a flu. Mm-hmm. Can you mention some things that would be helpful for people to look at or some things that people have been successful with in the past in terms
sure.
of assuming those for them?
Sure. I could say, for instance, one that I've more recently become aware of and that has helped me a lot in my what I call my village herbalism, that is just being the old man around here that gives people stuff when they're starting to get sick.
Yeah.
One is elderberry, black elderberry.
Yep.
Grow on the farm and harvest the berries in the fall, smash them, juice them, boil them down, and preserve them back with a little glycerin. And this becomes a elderberry syrup that we administer whenever somebody's starting to get sick. And it improves the immunity and kills a lot of the pathogenic organisms that
right.
that cause these diseases. And, you know, one of the things that happens is a person gets a cold. And there's nothing really, a cold isn't really bad. You could just sit through it. You wouldn't have to take anything. But then if you don't take care of it, then it can go into a secondary phase where there's
right.
inflammation, there may be excessive production of phlegm. The next thing you know, you're in the hospital with pneumonia.
Right.
So, you know, take care of yourself when you get sick. And so the elderberry is something that we've found to be very good for this, even better than echinacea, which we've used for many years to bolster the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll mention one other, which is a current favorite of mine, which is known mm-hmm. as Ashitaba. And Ashitaba is a A-S-H-I-T-A-B-A. It's a Angelica Kaisky Koizumi. This is a type of Angelica that comes from Japan that is
yeah.
loaded with vitamin B12, and it's very
mm-hmm.
difficult to find a botanical source of vitamin B12.
Sure.
It has a constituent inside the plant known as a chalcone, which is kind of a yellow resin. If you cut the plant open, the yellow mm-hmm. chalcones actually drip right out of it. And it looks
wow.
kind of like you cut open a vitamin B cap and
right.
and the inside of the cap is dripping out yellow, if you've ever done that. So this is a sort of a herbal panacea that just helps out in all kinds of conditions, including things like Epstein-Barr syndrome, where people are just always tired
and very prone to getting sick. Yeah.
I've had a naturopathic physician come into my greenhouse where I have large Ashitaba plants growing and have given her just a small piece of the stem, and she chews it up raw, and she says, this substance targets exactly the spot in your body that's ailing. And, you know, she
really?
Has a, yeah, she has a second sense or
uh-huh.
a fifth sense of healing, and really was able to just put her finger on the activity of the plant immediately. And so I see a lot of transformation around these kinds of superfoods, which come from all corners of the globe, and we try to bring them in and grow them and make them available to people. So, yeah, look into growing Ashitaba. It's called Tomorrow's Leaf. That is, if you pick a leaf today and eat it, there will be a new one tomorrow. It's a very fast-growing
wow.
Plant. And also, I think sometimes what it really means is if you eat it today trying to treat what's ailing you today, then you won't have that problem tomorrow.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah. No,
yeah.
I've never heard of it, but I'm definitely going to look at it.
Check the pictures on the website. Yeah.
Yeah. Ashitaba,
yeah.
That sounds great.
Ashitaba.
Have you had any experience with astragalus?
Sure, we grow our own astragalus here. Astragalus is in the milk vetch genus, which is the one of the largest groupings of plants on the earth. It includes other related plants such as loco weed, and so you
mm-hmm.
need to be sure that you're getting the right thing. But
yeah.
That's the Chinese herb. Wang Qi, which means yellow leader, and yellow leader in that it's one of the major herbs of traditional Chinese medicine. And this, too, is an immune-enhancing plant. It makes a root. You can grow the root in your garden, harvest it in the fall by digging it up, wash it, split it in half, and throw it in your soup, and it makes the soup into a rejuvenating soup. So it's not something
That's
fancy
great.
That you have to get at the health food store. You can just grow your own.
Yeah.
We sell 1,000 packets of that every year.
That's amazing. I will tell you that in our household, we have had very good luck with astragalus.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned, the reason I brought it up was because you had mentioned earlier the ability to, by treating a cold properly when you get it, you're avoiding pneumonia.
Sure.
With elderberry and so forth. And what we've noticed here is that not just my wife who has experienced this, but other people that I've recommended it to as well. I'm the old man here, by the way, that you prevent colds that, you know, when people have, some people when they have colds, they all tend to go into their chest. Then they tend to get bronchitis and sometimes pneumonia. We have actually cured pneumonia with astragalus in our household and prevented it a couple of other times when it was looking like it was going to develop that way. It's just a really, really good substance in that way. I mean, it really is very helpful with chest colds and all of that sort of thing.
Right. And, you know, if you were to, like, get my book, Making Plant Medicine, which is the first main book that we printed here, it was in 2000, I believe, that would give you definite directions on exactly how to work with astragalus root in making your own herbal formulas, tinctures and teas and what have you. So that would be a good resource for you. And the Chinese call astragalus a wellness herb, and they use it not only when they're feeling ill, but when they're feeling well in order to keep from getting sick.
That's right. It's an immune builder.
Yeah.
An immunity builder. Yeah. Good stuff. Let me ask you about a controversial subject, if I may. I don't know if you're aware of it, but very recently, Consumer Reports magazine. Do I have to say more, or do you already know about this?
I know about Consumer Reports, but I...
Well, no.
Explain to me what the issue is.
Yeah, okay. They just came out with some, I call it propaganda, saying that taking supplements and natural products can be dangerous to your health. And they talked about the 12 worst supplements you can take. Now, one thing in which they said, which I think is right, is that some things you buy in the stores may be subject to contamination. Okay, fair enough, but not everything. And obviously there are some checks on that. But they were really talking about the more fundamental issue, suggesting that it's a bad idea for your health to take supplements.
Well, I think that there are good supplements out there, and there are poor ones. And you can go to a naturopathic physician and get a referral towards some really, really excellent supplements that will help transform your life. It depends on who you are, and if you get some testing done first, then you can find out what it is that your diet is lacking, and what other kinds of health changes in your patterns of eating and nourishing yourself that, you know, might be indicated for maintaining your good health, vascular health especially. How much salt do you have, how much cholesterol do you have, and what have you. But what I ascribe to basically is a return to nature wherein you're growing core vegetables and herbs and incorporating those into your diet. They're more they're more readily assimilated vitamins than, and they're packed with balanced nutrients as well. Your body has an experience of how to break these things down and make use of them versus a pill that's going into your body that may or may not have the supplement profile that you really require. So I would say if you can't grow your own plants, if you can't, eat a vitamin-rich diet, then you'd better be taking some supplements, because otherwise you're really going to be in trouble. But if you can bring it closer to the garden, then you'll find that it's even more beneficial.
Yeah, and a lot of these herbs are also used as spices in cooking, or if you will, as taste enhancers in cooking that are really medicinal in nature.
Sure. I mean, the naturopaths tell us that if we don't do anything else, we should at least eat a raw garlic, clove of raw garlic every day.
Right.
Because it has a lot to do with maintaining vascular health, and heart disease and occluded arteries and veins are a major cause of death.
Sure.
In a society where we just bring in way too many fats, you know.
Yeah.
So this is obviously a culinary herb, but if you eat it raw and you eat it daily, it'll save your life.
That's right. Do you grow cayenne in your garden?
We do. We have a nice set of cayenne out there this year. We had a really cold spring, so some of our peppers and our tea basils, which are very important for us in terms of our income, were planted in a large cloche early on in the spring, and we had, I think, easily 3 weeks of cold and rain after I put them in the cloche. And then when it started to get warm, I just took the top off the cloche, and they were already well established. So we have a pretty nice set of bright green cayenne right now, and by fall they'll be bright red. We probably have 20 different capsicum species.
Wow.
In the catalog. So cayenne is one of them, and is really considered to be official in terms of the warming pepper of medicinal use.
There's two things I'm going to ask you to explain, and we're almost out of time.
Sure.
But not everybody knows what you were just talking about with a cloche, so I'll ask you to explain what that is. It's a gardening.
If you want to go on the website and request the fall catalog, it's just coming out. Mm-hmm. There are excellent directions on how to build your own cloche, which is a hoop house, a walk-in hoop house of a single piece of plastic,
good.
Which can drastically extend your
growing season
and bring a lot of greens into your life all the way up until Christmas. And it's inexpensive.
Yeah.
and a really good idea.
Right, it's kind of like in one sense a miniature greenhouse.
Oh yeah, an inexpensive, cheap hoop house that you can walk into that bumps you up a couple of zones in terms of your weather.
Right, in terms of hardiness and in terms of your growing.
Yes.
And, okay, and also talk for a minute, if you wouldn't mind, about the medicinal value of cayenne and the other capsicum
cayenne
plants.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, cayenne is going to stimulate the circulation, but it will be non-enervating. In other words, if you use a stimulant like caffeine, which stimulates the adrenal glands, then over a period of time, that becomes very exhausting to the body.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas something that's warming, like cayenne, is going to stimulate the circulation and increase the heartbeat a little bit, improve the digestion by warming the digestive fire, kill some deleterious bacteria in the system. And also, if you're taking it along with another medicinal herb, what it will do is it will course that herb through your entire body. So as you grow older, and if you feel like your fingers are getting cold, or your feet are getting really easily cold, then put a little cayenne in your diet, and that will help improve the circulation to the extremities, and that is how cayenne is used in herbal medicine.
And it's great stuff. By the way, let me just add, if you live in a really cold climate, live in a climate where you have really cold weather, putting a little cayenne in your shoes will keep your feet nice and warm.
Right.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm going to let you go. I would love to do this again. I know you're about to take off on a trip, but perhaps in a month or two, because we really just kind of scratched the surface. And I appreciate you being with us. This has been fascinating for me, and I suspect for the audience. The website is horizonherbs.com. One of the books is, I just had it in front of me, and now I've forgotten. I'm sorry.
One is Making Plant Medicine. That's sold about 100,000 copies in the U.S., and another is The Medicinal Herb
Grower.
Yes, which is new.
Okay.
Thanks, Jeff.
Great.
It's been great. I appreciate
Richo, thank
it.
You.
Yeah, take care.
You too. Have a good day, and have a great trip. Okay, bye-bye. And for those of you who are still with us, which I assume is everybody, we are going to transition in a moment into the Endpoint Essay. We invite you to join us next week, and thank you for joining us tonight. Our audience, for reasons I'm not fully aware of, continues to grow. Guests like Richo obviously are part of the reason that it grows. And therefore, if you have a guest to suggest to us, you can drop us a note at jb720@cox.net. And if you have a phone number for the person you're suggesting or other means of reaching them, that would be appreciated too. And in a couple of weeks on our anniversary of the show, we're going to be joined by Larry Hancock again. But for now, we're going to talk about yesterday's day in history, if you will. I was a semi-aware kid in August 1965, living in Los Angeles. Now, if on August 11th, and the several days after that, you lived in Southern California or watched the news, you were aware that something unusual occurred. I didn't live in a rich area by any means, but where we were was a lot better than Watts. By 1965, Los Angeles, unlike some cities in the Deep South, was no longer segregated as a matter of law, but it was definitely separated as a matter of fact. I don't think we had any African Americans at my elementary school or my junior high, and if I'm wrong, there was probably one. Some called it a riot, but an insurrection was more like it, and I say that not as a disparagement of the participants, but as an expression of the awareness that these folks weren't engaging in random violence. They were responding to bigotry, lack of work, and an unwillingness on the part of the dominant society to provide any kind of recognition. In those days in L.A. and many other places across the country, most whites knew no blacks. They couldn't even engage in the unadmitted bigot's expression of "some of my best friends are," because they weren't acquainted with a single African-American or Negro, as the more liberal among us referred to them then. So many of us gave little thought to what might be termed their plight. And if we gave little thought to that question, government was giving even less. Although the Civil Rights Act had passed the year before and more legislation was pending, they were mostly about prohibiting discrimination in housing and places of public accommodation. But if you were black, you were much less likely to find work, and meaningful work was a remote possibility. Immediately following those so-called riots that began 45 years ago yesterday, there were plenty of programs that were supposed to move African Americans closer to the mainstream and to the American bounty. But after a while, people forgot about those programs or voted against funding them, and the problems remained for a considerable period of our history. And now? Racism is solved, some say. After all, we have an African American president. But look who the other choice was. And do you really think that if we hadn't been on the verge of a second depression, he would have been victorious? Besides that, look at a more appropriate measure, the executive suite. Black people make up approximately 11% of the United States population. That would mean that if everything were truly equal, 55 of the Fortune 500 CEOs would be African American. The actual number when I last checked was 3. I'm not suggesting we need a quota system. But unless you believe that the color of one's skin dictates their suitability for leadership, the only other explanation for the extreme disparity is present or past racism. If you don't think there's racism, watch what happens the next time someone refers to someone's race. The tendency is to whisper like it's a secret. The person will look around the room if you're in a public place and say, "She's black." If that person's not you, you just learned something significant about the speaker and our society. Unemployment is much higher among blacks and other minorities than it is among whites. Their education is poorer and their opportunities are less than ours are. By ours, of course, I mean whites. If you don't think that reflects racism, maybe that says something about you. And with that, we've reached for tonight, the end point. Thanks for listening. Please join us next Thursday, 7:30 p.m. Pacific, 10:30 Eastern. And if you'd like to hear past shows, you can come to the same place you came to for this one, live. And thanks very much for joining us. We thank our producer, Autumn Leaves Bushman, who didn't growl during the broadcast tonight. Thank you. Be good. And come back next time, same bat time, same bat station. Thanks. Have a good night.